Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that?
Yeah.
No hassle?
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
Chapter 78 of Barnaby Rudge, A Tale of the Riots of 80. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recorded by Mill Nicholson. Barnaby Rudge, A Tale of the Riots of 80 by Charles Dickens. Chapter 78. On this same day, and about this very hour, Mr. Willet the elder sat smoking his pipe in a chamber at the Black Lion. Although it was hot summer weather, Mr. Willet sat close to the fire. He was in a state of profound cogitation, with his own thoughts, and it was his custom at such times to stew himself slowly, under the impression that that process of cookery was favourable to the melting out of his ideas, which, when he began to simmer, sometimes oozed forth so copiously as to astonish even himself. Mr. Willet had been several thousand times comforted by his friends and acquaintance, with the assurance that for the loss he had sustained in the damage done to the Maypole, he could come upon the county. But as this phrase happened to bear an unfortunate resemblance to the popular expression of coming on the parish, it suggested to Mr. Willet's mind no more consolatory visions than pauperism on an extensive scale, and ruin in a capacious aspect. Consequently, he had never failed to receive the intelligence with a rueful shake of the head or a dreary stare, and had been always observed to appear much more melancholy after a visit of condolence than at any other time in the whole 24 hours. It chanced, however, that sitting over the fire on this particular occasion, perhaps because he was, as it were, done to a turn, perhaps because he was in an unusually bright state of mind, perhaps because he had considered the subject so long, perhaps because of all these favouring circumstances taken together, it chanced that, sitting over the fire on this particular occasion, Mr. Willet did, afar off and in the remotest depths of his intellect, perceive a kind of lurking hint or faint suggestion that out of the public purse there might issue funds for the restoration of the Maypole to its former high place among the taverns of the earth. And this dim ray of light did so diffuse itself within him, and did so kindle up and shine, that at last he had it as plainly and visibly before him as the blaze by which he sat, and, fully persuaded that he was the first to make the discovery, and that he had started, hunted down, fallen upon, and knocked on the head a perfectly original idea which had never presented itself to any other man alive or dead, he laid down his pipe, rubbed his hands, and chuckled audibly. "Why, father!" cried Joe, entering at the moment, "you're in spirits today."
"It's nothing particular," said Mr. Willet, chuckling again. "It's nothing at all particular, Joseph. Tell me something about the Selwanners."
Having preferred this request, Mr. Willet chuckled a third time, and after these unusual demonstrations of levity, he put his pipe in his mouth again.
"What shall I tell you, father?"
asked Joe, laying his hand upon his sire's shoulder and looking down into his face.
"That I have come back? Poorer than a church mouse? You know that. That I have come back maimed and crippled? You know that."
"It was took off,"
muttered Mr. Willet, with his eyes upon the fire,
"at the defence of the Selwanners in America, where the war is."
"Quite right," returned Joe, smiling and leaning with his remaining elbow on the back of his father's chair. "The very subject I came to speak to you about. A man with one arm, father, is not of much use in the busy world.
This was one of those vast propositions which Mr. Willet had never considered for an instant, and required time to tackle. Wherefore he made no answer. "At all events," said Joe, "he can't pick and choose his means of earning a livelihood as another man may. He can't say, 'I will turn my hand to this,' or 'I won't turn my hand to that,' but must take what he can do, and be thankful it's no worse. What did you say?" Mr. Willet had been softly repeating to himself, in a musing tone, the words, "defence of the Salwanners." But he seemed embarrassed at having been overheard, and answered, "Nothing."
"Now look here, father. Mr. Edwards has come to England from the West Indies. When he was lost sight of, I ran away on the same day, father, he made a voyage to one of the islands, where a school friend of his had settled, and finding him, wasn't too proud to be employed on his estate, and in short, got on well, and is prospering, and has come over here on business of his own, and is going back again speedily. Our returning nearly at the same time, and meeting in the course of the late troubles, has been a good thing every way. For it has not only enabled us to do old friends some service, but has opened a path in life for me, which I may tread without being a burden upon you. To be plain, father, he can employ me. I have satisfied myself that I can be of real use to him, and I am going to carry my one arm away with him, and to make the most of it." In the mind's eye of Mr. Willet, the West Indies, and indeed all foreign countries, were inhabited by savage nations who were perpetually burying pipes of peace, flourishing tomahawks, and puncturing strange patterns in their bodies. He no sooner heard this announcement, therefore, than he leaned back in his chair, took his pipe from his lips, and stared at his son with as much dismay as if he already beheld him tied to a stake and tortured for the entertainment of a lively population. In what form of expression his feelings would have found a vent, it is impossible to say, nor is it necessary, for before a syllable occurred to him, Dolly Varden came running into the room in tears, threw herself on Joe's breast without a word of explanation, and clasped her white arms round his neck.
"Dolly!" cried Joe. "Dolly!"
"Aye, call me that! Call me that always!" exclaimed the locksmith's little daughter. "Never speak coldly to me. Never be distant. Never again reprove me for the follies I have long repented, or I shall die, Joe."
"I reprove you?" said Joe.
"Yes, for every kind and honest word you uttered went to my heart. For you, who have borne so much from me, for you who owe your sufferings and pain to my caprice, for you to be so kind, so noble to me, Joe."
He could say nothing to her, not a syllable. There was an odd sort of eloquence in his one arm, which had crept round her waist, but his lips were mute.
"If you had reminded me by a word, only by one short word," sobbed Dolly, clinging yet closer to him, "how little I deserve that you should treat me with so much forbearance. If you had exulted only for one moment in your triumph, I could have borne it better."
"Triumph?" repeated Joe, with a smile which seemed to say, "I am a pretty figure for that."
"Yes, triumph,"
she cried with her whole heart and soul in her earnest voice and gushing tears.
"For it is one. I am glad to think and know it is. I wouldn't be less humbled, dear. I wouldn't be without the recollection of that last time we spoke together in this place. No, not if I could recall the past and make our parting yesterday."
Did ever lover look as Joe looked now?
"Dear Joe," said Dolly, "I always loved you. In my own heart I always did, although I was so vain and giddy. I hoped you would come back that night. I made quite sure you would. I prayed for it on my knees. Through all these long, long years, I never once forgotten you, or left off hoping that this happy time might come."
The eloquence of Joe's arm surpassed the most impassioned language, and so did that of his lips. Yet he said nothing either.
"And now, at last,"
cried Dolly, trembling with the fervour of her speech,
"if you were sick and shattered in your every limb, if you were ailing, weak, and sorrowful, if, instead of being what you are, you were in everybody's eyes but mine the wreck and ruin of a man, I would be your wife, dear love, with greater pride and joy than if you were the stateliest lord in England."
"What have I done?" cried Joe. "What have I done to meet with this reward?"
"You have taught me," said Dolly,
raising her pretty face to his,
"to know myself and your worth, to be something better than I was, to be more deserving of your true and manly nature. In years to come, dear Joe, you shall find that you have done so. For I will be, not only now, when we are young and full of hope, but when we have grown old and weary, your patient, gentle, never-tiring wife. I will never know a wish or care beyond our home and you, and I will always study how to please you with my best affection and my most devoted love. I will, indeed I will."
Joe could only repeat his former eloquence, but it was very much to the purpose.
"They know of this at home," said Dolly. "For your sake, I would leave even them. But they know it, and are glad of it, and are as proud of you as I am, and as full of gratitude. You'll not come and see me as a poor friend who knew me when I was a girl, will you, dear Joe?"
Well, well. It don't matter what Joe said in answer, but he said a great deal. And Dolly said a great deal too. And he folded Dolly in his one arm pretty tight, considering that it was but one, and Dolly made no resistance. And if ever two people were happy in this world, which is not an utterly miserable one, with all its faults, we may, with some appearance of certainty, conclude that they were. To say that during these proceedings Mr. Willet the elder underwent the greatest emotions of astonishment of which our common nature is susceptible, to say that he was in a perfect paralysis of surprise, and that he wandered into the most stupendous and theretofore unattainable heights of complicated amazement, would be to shadow forth his state of mind in the feeblest and lamest terms. If a rock, an eagle, a griffin, a flying elephant, a winged sea-horse had suddenly appeared, and, taking him on its back, carried him bodily into the heart of the Salwanners, it would have been to him as an everyday occurrence in comparison with what he now beheld. To be sitting quietly by, seeing and hearing these things, to be completely overlooked, unnoticed, and disregarded, while his son and a young lady were talking to each other in the most impassioned manner, kissing each other, and making themselves in all respects perfectly at home, was a position so tremendous, so inexplicable, so utterly beyond the widest range of his capacity of comprehension, that he fell into a lethargy of wonder, and could no more rouse himself than an enchanted sleeper in the first year of his fairy lease a century long. "Father," said Joe, presenting Dolly, "you know who this is." Mr. Willet looked first at her, then at his son, then back again at Dolly, and then made an ineffectual effort to extract a whiff from his pipe, which had gone out long ago.
"Say a word, father, if it's only how do you do?" urged Joe.
"Certainly, Joseph," answered Mr. Willet. "Oh, yes. Why not?"
"To be sure," said Joe.
"Why not?"
"Ah," replied his father, "why not?"
And with this remark, which he uttered in a low voice, as though he were discussing some grave question with himself, he used the little finger, if any of his fingers can be said to have come under that denomination, of his right hand as a tobacco stopper, and was silent again. And so he sat for half an hour at least, although Dolly, in the most endearing of manners, hoped a dozen times that he was not angry with her. So he sat for half an hour, quite motionless, and looking all the while like nothing so much as a great Dutch pin or skittle. At the expiration of that period, he suddenly, and without the least notice, burst, to the great consternation of the young people, into a very loud and very short laugh, and repeating,
"Certainly, Joseph! Oh, yes! Why not?"
went out for a walk. End of chapter 78. Chapter 79 of Barnaby Rudge, A Tale of the Riots of 80. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recorded by Mill Nicholson. Barnaby Rudge, A Tale of the Riots of 80 by Charles Dickens. Chapter 79. Old John did not walk near the Golden Key, for between the Golden Key and the Black Lion there lay a wilderness of streets, as everybody knows who is acquainted with the relative bearings of Clerkenwell and Whitechapel, and he was by no means famous for pedestrian exercises. But the Golden Key lies in our way, though it was out of his, so to the Golden Key this chapter goes. The Golden Key itself, fair emblem of the locksmith's trade, had been pulled down by the rioters and roughly trampled underfoot. But now it was hoisted up again in all the glory of a new coat of paint, and showed more bravely even than in days of yore. Indeed, the whole house-front was spruce and trim, and so freshened up throughout, that if there yet remained at large any of the rioters who had been concerned in the attack upon it, the sight of the old, goodly, prosperous dwelling, so revived, must have been to them as gall and wormwood. The shutters of the shop were closed, however, and the window blinds above were all pulled down, and in place of its usual cheerful appearance the house had a look of sadness and an air of mourning, which the neighbours, who in old days had often seen poor Barnaby go in and out, were at no loss to understand. The door stood partly open, but the locksmith's hammer was unheard. The cat sat moping on the ashy forge. All was deserted, dark, and silent. On the threshold of this door, Mr. Haredale and Edward Chester met. The younger man gave place, and both passing in with a familiar air, which seemed to denote that they were tarrying there, or were well accustomed to go to and fro unquestioned, shut it behind them. Entering the old back parlour, and ascending the flight of stairs, abrupt and steep and quaintly fashioned as of old, they turned into the best room, the pride of Mrs. Varden's heart, and erst the scene of Miggs's household labours.
"Varden brought the mother here last evening, he told me," said Mr. Haredale.
"She is above stairs now, in the room over here," Edward rejoined. "Her grief, they say, is past all telling. I needn't add, for that you know beforehand, sir, that the care, humanity, and sympathy of these good people have no bounds."
"I am sure of that. Heaven repay them for it, and for much more. Varden is out?"
"He returned with your messenger, who arrived almost at the moment of his coming home himself. He was out the whole night. But that, of course, you know. He was with you the greater part of it."
"He was. Without him, I should have lacked my right hand. He's an older man than I, but nothing can conquer him."
"The cheeriest, stoutest-hearted fellow in the world."
"He has a right to be. He has a right to be. A better creature never lived. He reaps what he has sown, no more."
"It is not all men," said Edward, after a moment's hesitation, "who have the happiness to do that."
"More than you imagine," returned Mr. Haredale. "We note the harvest more than the seed-time. You do so in me."
In truth, his pale and haggard face and gloomy bearing had so far influenced the remark that Edward was for the moment at a loss to answer him. "Said Mr. Haredale,
"'twas not very difficult to read a thought so natural.
But you are mistaken, nevertheless. I have had my share of sorrows, more than the common lot, perhaps, but I have borne them ill. I have broken where I should have bent, and have mused and brooded when my spirit should have mixed with all God's great creation. The men who learn endurance are they who call the whole world brother. I have turned from the world, and I pay the penalty.
Edward would have interposed, but he went on without giving him time.
It is too late to evade it now. I sometimes think that if I had to live my life once more, I might amend this fault. Not so much, I discover when I search my mind, for the love of what is right, as for my own sake. But even when I make these better resolutions, I instinctively recoil from the idea of suffering again what I have undergone. And in this circumstance, I find the unwelcome assurance that I should still be the same man, though I could cancel the past and begin anew, with its experience to guide me.
"Nay, you make too sure of that," said Edward.
"You think so?" Mr. Haredale answered. "And I am glad you do. I know myself better, and therefore distrust myself more. Let us leave this subject for another, not so far removed from it as it might at first sight seem to be. Sir, you still love my niece, and she is still attached to you."
"I have that assurance from her own lips," said Edward. "And you know, I am sure you know, that I would not exchange it for any blessing life could yield me."
"You are frank, honourable, and disinterested," said Mr. Haredale. "You have forced the conviction that you are so, even on my once jaundiced mind, and I believe you. Wait here till I come back."
He left the room as he spoke, but soon returned with his niece.
"On that first and only time," he said, looking from the one to the other, "when we three stood together under her father's roof, I told you to quit it, and charged you never to return.
It is the only circumstance arising out of our love," observed Edward, "that I have forgotten."
"You own a name," said Mr. Haredale. "I had deep reason to remember. I was moved and goaded by recollections of personal wrong and injury, I know, but even now I cannot charge myself with having then or ever lost sight of a heartfelt desire for her true happiness, or with having acted, however much I was mistaken, with any other impulse than the one pure, single, earnest wish to be to her, as far as in my inferior nature lay, the father she had lost."
"Dear uncle," cried Emma, "I have known no parent but you. I have loved the memory of others, but I have loved you all my life. Never was father kinder to his child than you have been to me, without the interval of one harsh hour since I can first remember."
"You speak too fondly," he answered, "and yet I cannot wish you were less partial, for I have a pleasure in hearing those words, and shall have in calling them to mind when we are far asunder, which nothing else could give me."
"Bear with me for a moment longer, Edward, for she and I have been together many years, and although I believe that in resigning her to you I put the seal upon her future happiness, I find it needs an effort."
He pressed her tenderly to his bosom, and after a minute's pause resumed,
"I have done you wrong, sir, and I ask your forgiveness. In no common phrase or show of sorrow, but with earnestness and sincerity. In the same spirit, I acknowledge to you both that the time has been when I connived at treachery and falsehood, which, if I did not perpetrate myself, I still permitted to rend you two asunder."
"You judge yourself too harshly," said Edward. "Let these things rest. They rise in judgment against me when I look back, and not now for the first time," he answered.
"I cannot part from you without your full forgiveness, for busy life and I have little left in common now, and I have regrets enough to carry into solitude without addition to the stock."
"You bear a blessing from us both," said Emma. "Never mingle thoughts of me who owe you so much love and duty, with anything but undying affection and gratitude for the past, and bright hopes for the future."
"The future," returned her uncle, with a melancholy smile, "is a bright word for you, and its image should be wreathed with cheerful hopes. Mine is of another kind, but it will be one of peace, and free, I trust, from care or passion. When you quit England, I shall leave it too. There are cloisters abroad, and now that the two great objects of my life are set at rest, I know no better home. You droop at that, forgetting that I am growing old, and that my course is nearly run. Well, we will speak of it again, not once or twice, but many times, and you shall give me cheerful counsel, Emma."
"And you will take it?"
asked his niece. "I'll listen to it," he answered with a kiss, "and it will have its weight, be certain. What have I left to say? You have of late been much together. It is better and more fitting that the circumstances attendant on the past, which wrought your separation, and sowed between you suspicion and distrust, should not be entered on by me."
"Much, much better," whispered Emma.
"I avow my share in them," said Mr. Haredale, "though I held it, at the time, in detestation. Let no man turn aside, ever so slightly, from the broad path of honour, on the plausible pretence that he is justified by the goodness of his end. All good ends can be worked out by good means. Those that cannot are bad, and may be counted so at once, and left alone." He looked from her to Edward, and said in a gentler tone, "In goods and fortune, you are now nearly equal. I have been her faithful steward, and to that remnant of a richer property which my brother left her, I desire to add, in token of my love, a poor pittance, scarcely worth the mention, for which I have no longer any need. I am glad you go abroad. Let our ill-fated house remain the ruin it is. When you return, after a few thriving years, you will command a better and a more fortunate one. We are friends." Edward took his extended hand and grasped it heartily.
"You are neither slow nor cold in your response," said Mr. Haredale, doing the like by him, "and when I look upon you now, and know you, I feel that I would choose you for her husband. Her father had a generous nature, and you would have pleased him well. I give her to you in his name, and with his blessing. If the world and I part in this act, we part on happier terms than we have lived for many a day."
He placed her in his arms, and would have left the room, but that he was stopped in his passage to the door by a great noise at a distance, which made them start and pause. It was a loud shouting, mingled with boisterous acclamations, that rent the very air. It drew nearer and nearer every moment, and approached so rapidly that, even while they listened, it burst into a deafening confusion of sounds at the street corner.
"This must be stopped, quieted," said Mr. Haredale hastily. "We should have foreseen this, and provided against it. I will go out to them at once."
But before he could reach the door, and before Edward could catch up his hat and follow him, they were again arrested by a loud shriek from above stairs, and the locksmith's wife, bursting in and fairly running into Mr. Haredale's arms, cried out,
"She knows it all, dear sir! She knows it all! We broke it out to her by degrees, and she's quite prepared!"
Having made this communication, and furthermore thanked heaven with great fervour and heartiness, the good lady, according to the custom of matrons on all occasions of excitement, fainted away directly. They ran to the window, drew up the sash, and looked into the crowded street. Among a dense mob of persons, of whom not one was for an instant still, the locksmith's ruddy face and burly form could be descried,
beating about as though he were struggling with a rough sea. Now he was carried back a score of yards, now onward nearly to the door, now back again, now forced against the opposite houses, now against those adjoining his own, now carried up a flight of steps, and greeted by the outstretched hands of half a hundred men, while the whole tumultuous concourse stretched their throats and cheered with all their might. Though he was really in a fair way to be torn to pieces in the general enthusiasm, the locksmith, nothing discomposed, echoed their shouts till he was as hoarse as they, and in a glow of joy and right good humour waved his hat until the daylight shone between its brim and crown. But in all the bandings from hand to hand, and strivings to and fro, and sweepings here and there, which, saving that he looked more jolly and more radiant after every struggle, troubled his peace of mind no more than if he had been a straw upon the water's surface, he never once released his firm grasp of an arm drawn tight through his. He sometimes turned to clap this friend upon the back, or whisper in his ear a word of staunch encouragement, or cheer him with a smile, but his great care was to shield him from the pressure and force a passage for him to the Golden Key. Passive and timid, scared, pale and wondering, and gazing at the throng as if he were newly risen from the dead and felt himself a ghost among the living, Barnaby. Not Barnaby in the spirit, but in flesh and blood, with pulses, sinews, nerves and beating heart and strong affections, clung to his stout old friend and followed where he led. And thus, in course of time, they reached the door, held ready for their entrance by no unwilling hands. Then slipping in and shutting out the crowd by main force, Gabriel stood between Mr. Haredale and Edward Chester, and Barnaby, rushing up the stairs, fell upon his knees beside his mother's bed.
"Such is the blessed end, sir," cried the panting locksmith to Mr. Haredale, "of the best day's work we ever did. The rogues! It's been hard fighting to get away from him. I almost thought, once or twice, they'd have been too much for us, with their kindness."
They had striven all the previous day to rescue Barnaby from his impending fate. Failing in their attempts in the first quarter to which they addressed themselves, they renewed them in another. Failing there, likewise, they began afresh at midnight, and made their way not only to the judge and jury who had tried him, but to men of influence at court, to the young Prince of Wales, and even to the antechamber of the king himself. Successful at last in awakening an interest in his favour, and an inclination to inquire more dispassionately into his case, they had had an interview with the minister in his bed, so late as 8 o'clock that morning. The result of a searching inquiry, in which they, who had known the poor fellow from his childhood, did other good service, besides bringing it about, was that between 11 and 12 o'clock a free pardon to Barnaby Rudge was made out and signed and entrusted to a horse soldier for instant conveyance to the place of execution. This courier reached the spot just as the cart appeared in sight, and Barnaby being carried back to jail, Mr. Haredale, assured that all was safe, had gone straight from Bloomsbury Square to the Golden Key, leaving to Gabriel the grateful task of bringing him home in triumph.
"I needn't say," observed the locksmith, when he had shaken hands with all the males in the house, and hugged all the females, 45 times at least, "that, except among ourselves, I didn't want to make a triumph of it. But directly we got into the street we were known, and this hubbub began. Of the two," he added as he wiped his crimson face, "and after experience of both, I think I'd rather be taken out of my house by a crowd of enemies than escorted home by a mob of friends."
It was plain enough, however, that this was mere talk on Gabriel's part, and that the whole proceeding afforded him the keenest delight, for the people continuing to make a great noise without, and to cheer as if their voices were in the freshest order, and good for a fortnight, he sent upstairs for Grip, who had come home at his master's back, and had acknowledged the favours of the multitude by drawing blood from every finger that came within his reach, and with a bird upon his arm presented himself at the first floor window, and waved his hat again until it dangled by a shred between his finger and thumb. This demonstration having been received with appropriate shouts, and silence being in some degree restored, he thanked them for their sympathy, and taking the liberty to inform them that there was a sick person in the house, proposed that they should give 3 cheers for King George, 3 more for Old England, and 3 more for nothing particular, as a closing ceremony. The crowd assenting, substituted Gabriel Varden for the nothing particular, and giving him 1 over, for good measure, dispersed in high good humour. What congratulations were exchanged among the inmates of the Golden Key when they were left alone! What an overflowing of joy and happiness there was among them! How incapable it was of expression in Barnaby's own person! And how he went wildly from one to another, until he became so far tranquillized as to stretch himself on the ground beside his mother's couch, and fall into a deep sleep, are matters that need not be told. And it is well they happened to be of this class, for they would be very hard to tell, were their narration ever so indispensable. Before leaving this bright picture, it may be well to glance at a dark and very different one, which was presented to only a few eyes that same night. The scene was a churchyard, the time midnight, the persons Edward Chester, a clergyman, a gravedigger, and the 4 bearers of a homely coffin. They stood about a grave which had been newly dug, and one of the bearers held up a dim lantern, the only light there, which shed its feeble ray upon the book of prayer. He placed it for a moment on the coffin, when he and his companions were about to lower it down. There was no inscription on the lid. The mould fell solemnly upon the last house of this nameless man, and the rattling dust left a dismal echo even in the accustomed ears of those who had borne it to its resting-place. The grave was filled in to the top and trodden down. They all left the spot together.
"You never saw him living?" asked the clergyman of Edward.
"Often, years ago, not knowing him for my brother."
"Never since?"
"Never. Yesterday he steadily refused to see me. It was urged upon him many times at my desire.
Still he refused. That was hardened and unnatural."
"Do you think so?"
"I infer that you do not."
"You are right. We hear the world wonder every day at monsters of ingratitude. Did it never occur to you that it often looks for monsters of affection, as though they were things of course?" They had reached the gate by this time, and bidding each other good night, departed on their separate ways. End of chapter 79. Chapter 80 of Barnaby Rudge, A Tale of the Riots of 80. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recorded by Mill Nicholson. Barnaby Rudge, A Tale of the Riots of 80 by Charles Dickens. Chapter 80. That afternoon, when he had slept off his fatigue, had shaved and washed and dressed and freshened himself from top to toe, when he had dined, comforted himself with a pipe, an extra toby, a nap in the great armchair, and a quiet chat with Mrs. Varden on everything that had happened, was happening, or about to happen, within the sphere of their domestic concern, the locksmith sat himself down at the tea-table in the little back parlour, the rosiest, cosiest, merriest, heartiest, best-contented old buck in Great Britain or out of it. There he sat, with his beaming eye on Mrs. V, and his shining face suffused with gladness, and his capacious waistcoat smiling in every wrinkle, and his jovial humour peeping from under the table in the very plumpness of his legs, a sight to turn the vinegar of misanthropy into purest milk of human kindness. There he sat, watching his wife as she decorated the room with flowers for the greater honour of Dolly and Joseph Willet, who had gone out walking, and for whom the tea-kettle had been singing gaily on the hob full 20 minutes, chirping as never kettle chirped before, for whom the best service of real undoubted china, patterned with divers round-faced mandarins holding up broad umbrellas, was now displayed in all its glory,
to tempt whose appetites a clear, transparent, juicy ham, garnished with cool green lettuce leaves and fragrant cucumber, reposed upon a shady table, covered with a snow-white cloth. For whose delight preserves and jams, crisp cakes and other pastry, short to eat, with cunning twists and cottage loaves and rolls of bread, both white and brown, were all set forth in rich profusion. In whose youth Mrs. V. herself had grown quite young, and stood there in a gown of red and white, symmetrical in figure, buxom in bodice, ruddy in cheek and lip, faultless in ankle, laughing in face and mood, in all respects delicious to behold. There sat the locksmith, among all and every these delights, the sun that shone upon them all, the centre of the system, the source of light, heat, life, and frank enjoyment in the bright household world. And when had Dolly ever been the Dolly of that afternoon? To see how she came in arm with Joe, and how she made an effort not to blush or seem at all confused, and how she made believe she didn't care to sit on his side of the table, and how she coaxed the locksmith in a whisper not to joke, and how her colour came and went in a little restless flutter of happiness, which made her do everything wrong, and yet so charmingly wrong that it was better than right. Why, the locksmith could have looked on at this, as he mentioned to Mrs. Varden when they retired for the night, for 24 hours at a stretch, and never wished it done. The recollections, too, with which they made merry over that long protracted tea, the glee with which the locksmith asked Joe if he remembered that stormy night at the Maypole when he first asked after Dolly, the laugh they all had about that night when she was going out to the party in the sedan chair, the unmerciful manner in which they rallied Mrs. Varden about putting those flowers outside that very window, the difficulty Mrs. Varden found in joining the laugh against herself at first, and the extraordinary perception she had of the joke when she overcame it, the confidential statements of Joe concerning the precise day and hour when he was first conscious of being fond of Dolly, and Dolly's blushing admissions, half volunteered and half extorted, as to the time from which she dated the discovery that she didn't mind Joe. Here was an exhaustless fund of mirth and conversation. Then there was a great deal to be said regarding Mrs. Varden's doubts, and motherly alarms, and shrewd suspicions, and it appeared that from Mrs. Varden's penetration and extreme sagacity nothing had ever been hidden. She had known it all along. She had seen it from the first. She had always predicted it. She had been aware of it before the principals. She had said within herself, for she remembered the exact words, that young Willet is certainly looking after our Dolly, and I must look after him. Accordingly, she had looked after him, and had observed many little circumstances, all of which she named, so exceedingly minute, that nobody else could make anything out of them even now, and had, it seemed from first to last, displayed the most unbounded tact and most consummate generalship. Of course, the night when Joe would ride homeward by the side of the chaise, and when Mrs. Varden would insist upon his going back again, was not forgotten, nor the night when Dolly fainted on his name being mentioned, nor the times upon times when Mrs. Varden, ever watchful and prudent, had found her pining in her own chamber. In short, nothing was forgotten, and everything by some means or other brought them back to the conclusion that that was the happiest hour in all their lives. Consequently, that everything must have occurred for the best, and nothing could be suggested which would have made it better. While they were in the full glow of such discourse as this, there came a startling knock at the door, opening from the street into the workshop, which had been kept closed all day, that the house might be more quiet. Joe, as in duty bound, would hear of nobody but himself going to open it, and accordingly left the room for that purpose. It would have been odd enough, certainly, if Joe had forgotten the way to this door, and even if he had, as it was a pretty large one, and stood straight before him, he could not easily have missed it. But Dolly, perhaps because she was in the flutter of spirits before mentioned, or perhaps because she thought he would not be able to open it with his one arm, she could have had no other reason, hurried out after him, and they stopped so long in the passage, no doubt owing to Joe's entreaties that she would not expose herself to the draught of July air which must infallibly come rushing in on this same door being opened, that the knock was repeated, in a yet more startling manner than before.
"Is anybody going to open that door?" cried the locksmith. "Or shall I come?"
Upon that, Dolly went running back into the parlour, all dimples and blushes, and Joe opened it with a mighty noise and other superfluous demonstrations of being in a violent hurry.
"Well?" said the locksmith, when he reappeared. "What is it? Eh, Joe? What are you laughing at?"
"Nothing, sir. It's coming in."
"Who's coming in? What's coming in?"
Mrs. Varden, as much at a loss as her husband, could only shake her head in answer to his inquiring look. So the locksmith wheeled his chair round to command a better view of the room door, and stared at it with his eyes wide open, and a mingled expression of curiosity and wonder shining in his jolly face. Instead of some person or persons straightway appearing, diverse remarkable sounds were heard, first in the workshop, and afterwards in the little dark passage between it and the parlour, as though some unwieldy chest or heavy piece of furniture were being brought in, by an amount of human strength inadequate to the task. At length, after much struggling and humping and bruising of the wall on both sides, the door was forced open as by a battering ram, and the locksmith, steadily regarding what appeared beyond, smote his thigh, elevated his eyebrows, opened his mouth, and cried in a loud voice expressive of the utmost consternation,
"Damn! If it an't Miggs come back!"
The young damsel, whom he named, no sooner heard these words, than deserting a small boy and a very large box by which she was accompanied, and advancing with such precipitation that her bonnet flew off her head, burst into the room, clasped her hands, in which she held a pair of pattens, one in each, raised her eyes devotedly to the ceiling, and shed a flood of tears.
"The old story!" cried the locksmith, looking at her in inexpressible desperation. "She was born to be a damper, this young woman. Nothing can prevent it."
"Ho, master! Ho, mim!"
cried Miggs.
"Can I constrain my feelings in these here once again united moments? Ho, Mr. Warson, here's blessedness among relations, sir. Here's forgiveness of injuries. Here's amicablenesses."
The locksmith looked from his wife to Dolly, and from Dolly to Joe, and from Joe to Miggs, with his eyebrows still elevated and his mouth still open. When his eyes got back to Miggs, they rested on her, fascinated.
"To think," cried Miggs with hysterical joy, "that Mr. Joe and dear Miss Dolly has raly come together after all has been said and done contrary. To see them two a-settling along with him, and her so pleasant and in all respects so affable and mild, and me not knowing of it, and not being in the ways to make no preparations for their teas. Ho! Oh, what a cutting thing it is, and yet what sweet sensations is awoke within me!"
Either in clasping her hands again, or in an ecstasy of pious joy, Miss Miggs clinked her pattens, after the manner of a pair of cymbals, at this juncture, and then resumed in the softest accents.
"And did my missus think, oh, goodness, did she think, as her own Miggs, which supported her under so many trials, and understood her nature, when them as intended well but acted rough, went so deep into her feelings, did she think as her own Miggs would ever leave her? Did she think as Miggs, though she was but a servant, and know that servitudes was now inheritances, would forget that she was the humble instruments as always made it comfortable between them two when they fell out, and always told master of the meekness and forgiveness of her blessed dispositions? Did she think as Miggs had no attachments? Did she think that wages was her only object?"
To none of these interrogatories, whereof every one was more pathetically delivered than the last, did Mrs. Varden answer one word. But Miggs, not at all abashed by this circumstance, turned to the small boy in attendance, her eldest nephew, son of her own married sister, born in Golden Lion Court number 27, and bred in the very shadow of the second bell-handle on the right-hand doorpost, and with a plentiful use of her pocket-handkerchief, addressed herself to him, requesting that on his return home he would console his parents for the loss of her, his aunt,
by delivering to them a faithful statement of his having left her in the bosom of that family with which, as his aforesaid parents well knew, her best affections were incorporated, that he would remind them that nothing less than her imperious sense of duty and devoted attachment to her old master and missus, likewise Miss Dolly and young Mr. Joe, should ever have induced her to decline that pressing invitation which they, his parents, had, as he could testify, given her, to lodge and board with them, free of all cost and charge, for evermore. Lastly, that he would help her with her box upstairs, and then repair straight home, bearing her blessing and her strong injunctions to mingle in his prayers a supplication that he might in course of time grow up a locksmith, or a Mr. Joe, and have Mrs. Varden's and Miss Dolly's for his relations and friends. Having brought this admonition to an end, upon which, to say the truth, the young gentleman for whose benefit it was designed bestowed little or no heed, having to all appearance his faculties absorbed in the contemplation of the sweetmeats, Miss Miggs signified to the company in general that they were not to be uneasy, for she would soon return, and with her nephew's aid, prepared to bear her wardrobe up the staircase.
"My dear," said the locksmith to his wife, "do you desire this?"
"I desire it," she answered. "I am astonished. I am amazed at her audacity. Let her leave the house this moment."
Miggs, hearing this, let her end of the box fall heavily to the floor, gave a very loud sniff, crossed her arms, screwed down the corners of her mouth, and cried, in an ascending scale,
"How? Good gracious!"
three distinct times.
"You hear what your mistress says, my love," remarked the locksmith. "You had better go, I think. Stay, take this with you for the sake of old service."
Miss Miggs clutched the banknote he took from his pocket-book, and held out to her, deposited it in a small red leather purse, put the purse in her pocket, displaying as she did so a considerable portion of some undergarment made of flannel, and more black cotton stocking than is commonly seen in public, and, tossing her head, as she looked at Mrs. Varden, repeated,
"How! Good gracious!"
"I think you said that once before, my dear," observed the locksmith.
"Times is changed, I say, mim,"
cried Miggs, bridling.
"You can spare me now, can you? You can keep 'em down without me. You're not in wants of any one to scold or throw the blame upon no longer, an't you, mim? I'm glad to find you've grown so independent. I wish you joy, I'm sure."
With that she dropped a curtsey, and keeping her head erect, her ear towards Mrs. Varden, and her eye on the rest of the company, as she alluded to them in her remarks, proceeded.
"I'm quite delighted, I'm sure, to find such independency. Feeling sorry, though, at the same time, mim, that you should have been forced into submissions when you couldn't help yourself. You must be great vexations, especially considering how ill you always spoke of Mr. Joe, to have him for a son-in-law at last. And I wonder Miss Dolly can put up with him either, after being off and on for so many years with a coachmaker. But I have heard say that the coachmaker thought twice about it, and that he told a young man as was a friend of his that he hoped he knowed better than to be drawed into that, though she and all the family did pull uncommon strong."
Here she paused for a reply, and receiving none, went on as before.
"I have heard say, mim, that the illnesses of some ladies was all pretensions, and that they could faint away stone dead whenever they had the inclination so to do. Of course I never see such cases with my own eyes, oh no! Nor master either, oh no! I have heard the neighbours make remark as someone as they was acquainted with was a poor, good-natured, mean-spirited creature as went out fishing for a wife one day and caught a tartar. Of course, I never to my knowledge see the poor person himself. Nor did you neither, mim. Oh, no. I wonder who it can be. Don't you, mim? No doubt you do, mim. Oh, yes."
Again Miggs paused for a reply, and none being offered, was so oppressed with teeming spite and spleen that she seemed like to burst.
"I'm glad Miss Dolly can laugh," cried Miggs with a feeble titter. "I like to see folks a-laughing. So do you, Mim, don't you? You was always glad to see people in spirits, wasn't you, Mim? And you always did your best to keep 'em cheerful, didn't you, Mim? Though there aren't such a great deal to laugh at now, either, is there, Mim? It aren't so much of a catch, after looking out so sharp ever since you was a little chit, and costing such a deal in dress and show, to get a poor common soldier with one arm, is it, Mim? I wouldn't have a husband with one arm anyways. I would have two arms. I would have two arms if it was me. Though instead of hands, they'd only got hooks at the end, like our dustman."
Miss Miggs was about to add, and had indeed begun to add, that, taking them in the abstract, dustmen were far more eligible matches than soldiers, though, to be sure, when people were past choosing, they must take the best they could get, and think themselves well off too, but her vexation and chagrin being of that internally bitter sort which finds no relief in words, and is aggravated to madness by want of contradiction, she could hold out no longer, and burst into a storm of sobs and tears. In this extremity she fell on the unlucky nephew, tooth and nail, and plucking a handful of hair from his head, demanded to know how long she was to stand there to be insulted, and whether or no he meant to help her to carry out the box again, and if he took a pleasure in hearing his family reviled, with other inquiries of that nature, at which disgrace and provocation the small boy, who had been all this time gradually lashed into rebellion by the sight of unattainable pastry, walked off indignant, leaving his aunt and the box to follow at their leisure. Somehow or other, by dint of pushing and pulling, they did attain the street at last, where Miss Miggs, all bloused with the exertion of getting there, and with her sobs and tears, sat down upon her property to rest and grieve, until she could ensnare some other youth to help her home.
"It's a thing to laugh at, Martha, not to care for," whispered the locksmith, as he followed his wife to the window and good-humouredly dried her eyes. "What does it matter? You had seen your fault before. Come, bring up Toby again, my dear. Dolly shall sing us a song, and we'll be all the merrier for this interruption."
End of chapter 80. Chapter 81 of Barnaby Rudge, A Tale of the Riots of 80. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recorded by Mill Nicholson. Barnaby Rudge, A Tale of the Riots of 80. By Charles Dickens. Chapter 81. Another month had passed, and the end of August had nearly come, when Mr. Haredale stood alone in the mail-coach office at Bristol. Although but a few weeks had intervened since his conversation with Edward Chester and his niece in the locksmith's house, and he had made no change, in the meantime, in his accustomed style of dress, his appearance was greatly altered. He looked much older, and more careworn. Agitation and anxiety of mind scatter wrinkles and grey hairs with no unsparing hand, but deeper traces follow on the silent uprooting of old habits, and severing of dear, familiar ties. The affections may not be so easily wounded as the passions, but their hurts are deeper and more lasting. He was now a solitary man, and the heart within him was dreary and lonesome. He was not the less alone for having spent so many years in seclusion and retirement. This was no better preparation than a round of social cheerfulness. Perhaps it even increased the keenness of his sensibility. He had been so dependent upon her for companionship and love. She had come to be so much a part and parcel of his existence. They had had so many cares and thoughts in common, which no one else had shared, that losing her was beginning life anew, and being required to summon up the hope and elasticity of youth amid the doubts, distrusts, and weakened energies of age. The effort he had made to part from her with seeming cheerfulness and hope, and they had parted only yesterday, left him the more depressed. With these feelings he was about to revisit London for the last time, and look once more upon the walls of their old home before turning his back upon it for ever. The journey was a very different one in those days from what the present generation find it, but it came to an end as the longest journey will, and he stood again in the streets of the metropolis. He lay at the inn where the coach stopped, and resolved, before he went to bed, that he would make his arrival known to no one, would spend but another night in London, and would spare himself the pang of parting, even with the honest locksmith. Such conditions of the mind as that to which he was a prey when he lay down to rest are favourable to the growth of disordered fancies and uneasy visions. He knew this, even in the horror with which he started from his first sleep, and threw up the window to dispel it by the presence of some object beyond the room which had not been, as it were, the witness of his dream. But it was not a new terror of the night. It had been present to him before, in many shapes. It had haunted him in bygone times, and visited his pillow again and again. If it had been but an ugly object, a childish spectre, haunting his sleep, its return in its old form might have awakened a momentary sensation of fear, which, almost in the act of waking, would have passed away. This disquiet, however, lingered about him, and would yield to nothing. When he closed his eyes again, he felt it hovering near. As he slowly sunk into a slumber, he was conscious of its gathering strength and purpose, and gradually assuming its recent shape. When he sprang up from his bed, the same phantom vanished from his heated brain, and left him filled with a dread against which reason and waking thought were powerless. The sun was up before he could shake it off. He rose late, but not refreshed, and remained within doors all that day. He had a fancy for paying his last visit to the old spot in the evening, for he had been accustomed to walk there at that season, and desired to see it under the aspect that was most familiar to him. At such an hour as would afford him time to reach it a little before sunset, he left the inn and turned into the busy street. He had not gone far, and was thoughtfully making his way among the noisy crowd, when he felt a hand upon his shoulder, and, turning, recognised one of the waiters from the inn, who begged his pardon, but he had left his sword behind him.
"Why have you brought it to me?"
he asked, stretching out his hand, and yet not taking it from the man, but looking at him in a disturbed and agitated manner. The man was sorry to have disobliged him, and would carry it back again. The gentleman had said he was going a little way into the country, and that he might not return until late. The roads were not very safe for single travellers after dark, and since the riots, gentlemen had been more careful than ever not to trust themselves unarmed in lonely places.
"We thought you were a stranger, sir," he added, "and that you might believe our roads to be better than they are, but perhaps you know them well and carry firearms."
He took the sword, and putting it up at his side, thanked the man and resumed his walk. It was long remembered that he did this in a manner so strange, and with such a trembling hand, that the messenger stood looking after his retreating figure, doubtful whether he ought not to follow and watch him. It was long remembered that he had been heard pacing his bedroom in the dead of the night, that the attendants had mentioned to each other in the morning how fevered and how pale he looked, and that when this man went back to the inn, he told a fellow servant that what he had observed in this short interview lay very heavy on his mind, and that he feared the gentleman intended to destroy himself, and would never come back alive. With the half-consciousness that his manner had attracted the man's attention, remembering the expression of his face when they parted, Mr. Haredale quickened his steps, and arriving at a stand of coaches, bargained with the driver of the best to carry him so far on his road as the point where the footway struck across the fields, and to await his return at a house of entertainment which was within a stone's throw of that place. Arriving there in due course, he alighted and pursued his way on foot. He passed so near the maypole that he could see its smoke rising from among the trees, while a flock of pigeons, some of its old inhabitants, doubtless, sailed gaily home to roost between him and the unclouded sky.
"The old house will brighten up now," he said, as he looked towards it, "and there will be a merry fireside beneath its ivied roof. It is some comfort to know that everything will not be blighted hereabouts. I shall be glad to have one picture of life and cheerfulness to turn to, in my mind."
He resumed his walk, and bent his steps towards the Warren. It was a clear, calm, silent evening, with hardly a breath of wind to stir the leaves, or any sound to break the stillness of the time, but drowsy sheep bells tinkling in the distance, and at intervals the far-off lowing of cattle or bark of village dogs. The sky was radiant with the softened glory of sunset, and on the earth and in the air a deep repose prevailed. At such an hour he arrived at the deserted mansion which had been his home so long, and looked for the last time upon its blackened walls. The ashes of the commonest fire are melancholy things, for in them there is an image of death and ruin, of something that has been bright and is but dull, cold, dreary dust, with which our nature forces us to sympathize. How much more sad the crumbled embers of a home, the casting down of that great altar where the worst among us sometimes perform the worship of the heart, and where the best have offered up such sacrifices and done such deeds of heroism as, chronicled, would put the proudest temples of old time, with all their vaunting annals, to the blush. He roused himself from a long train of meditation, and walked slowly round the house. It was by this time almost dark. He had nearly made the circuit of the building when he uttered a half-suppressed exclamation, started, and stood still. Reclining in an easy attitude, with his back against a tree, and contemplating the ruin with an expression of pleasure, a pleasure so keen that it overcame his habitual indolence and command of feature, and displayed itself utterly free from all restraint or reserve. Before him, on his own ground, and triumphing then, as he had triumphed in every misfortune and disappointment of his life, stood the man whose presence, of all mankind, in any place, and least of all in that, he could the least endure. Although his blood so rose against this man, and his wrath so stirred within him, that he could have struck him dead, he put such fierce constraint upon himself that he passed him without a word or look. Yes, and he would have gone on, and not turned, though to resist the devil who poured such hot temptation in his brain required an effort scarcely to be achieved, if this man had not himself summoned him to stop, and that with an assumed compassion in his voice which drove him well-nigh mad, and in an instant routed all the self-command it had been anguish, acute, poignant anguish, to sustain. All consideration, reflection, mercy, forbearance, everything by which a goaded man can curb his rage and passion, fled from him as he turned back. And yet, he said, slowly and quite calmly, far more calmly than he had ever spoken to him before,
"Why have you called to me?"
"To remark," said Sir John Chester, with his wonted composure, "what an odd chance it is that we should meet here."
"It is a strange chance."
"Strange? The most remarkable and singular thing in the world. I never ride in the evening. I have not done so for years. The whim seized me, quite unaccountably, in the middle of last night. How very picturesque this is." He pointed as he spoke to the dismantled house, and raised his glass to his eye.
"You praise your own work very freely."
Sir John let fall his glass, inclined his face towards him with an air of the most courteous inquiry, and slightly shook his head as though he were remarking to himself, "I fear this animal is going mad."
"I say, you praise your own work very freely," repeated Mr. Haredale.
"Work?" echoed Sir John, looking smilingly round. "Mine? I beg your pardon. I really beg your pardon."
"Why, you see," said Mr. Haredale, "those walls, you see those tottering gables, you see on every side where fire and smoke have raged, you see the destruction that has been wanton here, do you not?"
"My
good friend," returned the knight, gently checking his impatience with his hand. "Of course I do. I see everything you speak of, when you stand aside and do not interpose yourself between the view and me. I am very sorry for you. If I had not had the pleasure to meet you here, I think I should have written to tell you so. But you don't bear it as well as I had expected. Excuse me, no, you don't indeed." He pulled out his snuff-box, and addressing him with the superior air of a man who, by reason of his higher nature, has a right to read a moral lesson to another, continued, "For you are a philosopher, you know, one of that stern and rigid school who are far above the weaknesses of mankind in general. You are removed a long way from the frailties of the crowd. You contemplate them from a height, and rail at them with the most impressive bitterness. I have heard you." "And shall again," said Mr. Haredale. "Thank you," returned the other. "Shall we walk as we talk? The damp falls rather heavily." "Well, as you please. But I grieve to say that I can spare you only a very few moments."
"I would," said Mr. Haredale. "You had spared me none. I would with all my soul you had been in paradise, if such a monstrous lie could be enacted, rather than here to-night."
"Nay," returned the other, "really, you do yourself injustice. You are a rough companion, but I would not go so far to avoid you."
"Listen to me," said Mr. Haredale. "Listen to me."
"While you rail?" inquired Sir John.
"While I deliver your infamy. You urged and stimulated to do your work a fit agent, but one who in his nature, in the very essence of his being, is a traitor, and who has been false to you, despite the sympathy you two should have together, as he has been to all others. With hints and looks and crafty words which told again on nothing, you set on Gashford to this work before us now. With these same hints and looks and crafty words which told again on nothing, you urged him on to gratify the deadly hate he owes me. I have earned it. I thank heaven by the abduction and dishonour of my niece. You did. I see denial in your looks," he cried abruptly, pointing in his face and stepping back, "and denial is a lie." He had his hand upon his sword, but the knight, with a contemptuous smile, replied to him as coldly as before.
"You will take notice, sir, if you can discriminate sufficiently, that I have taken the trouble to deny nothing. Your discernment is hardly fine enough for the perusal of faces, not of a kind as coarse as your speech, nor has it ever been that I remember. Or, in one face that I could name, you would have read indifference, not to say disgust, somewhat sooner than you did. I speak of a long time ago, but you understand me. Disguise it as you will, you mean denial. Denial, explicit or reserved, expressed or left to be inferred, is still a lie. You say you don't deny. Do you admit?"
"You yourself," returned Sir John, suffering the current of his speech to flow as smoothly as if it had been stemmed by no one word of interruption,
"publicly proclaimed the character of the gentleman in question. I think it was in Westminster Hall, in terms which relieve me from the necessity of making any further allusion to him. You may have been warranted, you may not have been, I can't say. Assuming the gentleman to be what you described, and to have made to you or any other person any statements that may have happened to suggest themselves to him, for the sake of his own security, or for the sake of money, or for his own amusement, or for any other consideration, I have nothing to say of him, except that his extremely degrading situation appears to me to be shared with his employers. You are so very plain yourself that you will excuse a little freedom in me, I am sure. Attend to me again, Sir John, but once, cried Mr. Haredale. In your every look and word and gesture, you tell me this was not your act. I tell you that it was, and that you tampered with the man I speak of, and with your wretched son, whom God forgive, to do this deed. You talk of degradation and character. You told me once that you had purchased the absence of the poor idiot and his mother, when, as I have discovered since, and then suspected, you had gone to tempt them, and had found them flown. To you I trace the insinuation that I alone reaped any harvest for my brother's death, and all the foul attacks and whispered calumnies that followed in its train. In every action of my life, from that first hope which you converted into grief and desolation, you have stood like an adverse fate between me and peace. In all, you have ever been the same cold-blooded, hollow, false, unworthy villain. For the second time, and for the last, I cast these charges in your teeth, and spurn you from me as I would a faithless dog. With that he raised his arm, and struck him on the breast, so that he staggered. Sir John, the instant he recovered, drew his sword, threw away the scabbard and his hat, and running on his adversary, made a desperate lunge at his heart, which, but that his guard was quick and true, would have stretched him dead upon the grass. In the act of striking him, the torrent of his opponent's rage had reached a stop. He parried his rapid thrusts, without returning them, and called to him with a frantic kind of terror in his face to keep back. "Not tonight! Not tonight!" he cried. "In God's name, not tonight!" Seeing that he lowered his weapon, and that he would not thrust in turn, Sir John lowered his. "Not tonight," his adversary cried. "Be warned in time." "You told me it must have been in a sort of inspiration," said Sir John, quite deliberately, though now he dropped his mask and showed his hatred in his face, "that this was the last time." "Be assured it is. Did you believe our last meeting was forgotten? Did you believe that your every word and look was not to be accounted for, and was not well remembered? Do you believe that I have waited your time, or you mine? What kind of man is he who entered, with all his sickening cant of honesty and truth, into a bond with me to prevent a marriage he affected to dislike? And when I had redeemed my part to the spirit and the letter, skulked from his, and brought the match about in his own time, to rid himself of a burden he had grown tired of, and cast a spurious lustre on his house? I have acted," cried Mr. Haredale, "with honour and in good faith. I do so now. Do not force me to renew this duel tonight."
"You said my wretched son, I think," said Sir John with a smile. "Poor fool! The dupe of such a shallow knave, trapped into marriage by such an uncle and by such a niece, he well deserves your pity. But he is no longer a son of mine. You are welcome to the prize your craft has made, sir."
"Once more," cried his opponent, wildly stamping on the ground, "although you tear me from my better angel, I implore you not to come within the reach of my sword tonight. Oh, why were you here at all? Why have we met? Tomorrow would have cast us far apart for ever."
"That being the case," returned Sir John, without the least emotion, "it is very fortunate we have met tonight. Haredale, I've always despised you, as you know, but I have given you credit for a species of brute courage. For the honour of my judgment, which I had thought a good one, I am sorry to find you a coward."
Not another word was spoken on either side. They crossed swords, though it was now quite dusk, and attacked each other fiercely. They were well matched, and each was thoroughly skilled in the management of his weapon. After a few seconds they grew hotter and more furious, and pressing on each other inflicted and received several slight wounds. It was directly after receiving one of these in his arm that Mr. Haredale, making a keener thrust as he felt the warm blood spurting out, plunged his sword through his opponent's body to the hilt. Their eyes met, and were on each other as he drew it out. He put his arm about the dying man, who repulsed him, feebly, and dropped upon the turf. Raising himself upon his hands, he gazed at him for an instant, with scorn and hatred in his look. But, seeming to remember, even then, that this expression would distort his features after death, he tried to smile, and, faintly moving his right hand, as if to hide his bloody linen in his vest, fell back dead. The phantom of last night. End of chapter 81. Chapter 82 of Barnaby Rudge, A Tale of the Riots of 80. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recorded by Mill Nicholson. Barnaby Rudge, A Tale of the Riots of 80, by Charles Dickens. Chapter the Last. A parting glance at such of the actors in this little history as it has not, in the course of its events, dismissed, will bring it to an end. Mr. Haredale fled that night. Before pursuit could be begun, indeed before Sir John was traced or missed, he had left the kingdom, repairing straight to a religious establishment, known throughout Europe for the rigour and severity of its discipline, and for the merciless penitence it exacted from those who sought its shelter as a refuge from the world. He took the vows which thenceforth shut him out from nature and his kind, and after a few remorseful years was buried in its gloomy cloisters. 2 days elapsed before the body of Sir John was found. As soon as it was recognised and carried home, the faithful valet, true to his master's creed, eloped with all the cash and movables he could lay his hands on, and started as a finished gentleman upon his own account. In this career he met with great success, and would certainly have married an heiress in the end, but for an unlucky check which led to his premature decease. He sank under a contagious disorder, very prevalent at that time, and vulgarly termed the jail fever. Lord George Gordon remained in his prison in the Tower until Monday the 5th of February in the following year, was on that day solemnly tried at Westminster for high treason. Of this crime he was, after a patient investigation, declared not guilty, upon the ground that there was no proof of his having called the multitude together with any traitorous or unlawful intentions. Yet so many people were there, still, to whom those riots taught no lesson of reproof or moderation, that a public subscription was set on foot in Scotland to defray the cost of his defence. For 7 years afterwards he remained, at the strong intercession of his friends, comparatively quiet, saving that he every now and then took occasion to display his zeal for the Protestant faith in some extravagant proceeding which was the delight of its enemies, and saving, besides, that he was formally excommunicated by the Archbishop of Canterbury for refusing to appear as a witness in the ecclesiastical court when cited for that purpose. In the year 1788 he was stimulated by some new insanity to write and publish an injurious pamphlet reflecting on the Queen of France in very violent terms, being indicted for the libel, and after various strange demonstrations in court, found guilty. He fled into Holland in place of appearing to receive sentence, from whence, as the quiet burgomasters of Amsterdam had no relish for his company, he was sent home again with all speed. Arriving in the month of July at Harwich, and going thence to Birmingham, he made in the latter place in August a public profession of the Jewish religion, and figured there as a Jew until he was arrested, and brought back to London to receive the sentence he had evaded. By virtue of this sentence, he was, in the month of December, cast into Newgate for 5 years and 10 months, and required besides to pay a large fine, and to furnish heavy securities for his future good behaviour. After addressing, in the midsummer of the following year, an appeal to the commiseration of the National Assembly of France, which the English minister refused to sanction, he composed himself to undergo his full term of punishment, and suffering his beard to grow nearly to his waist, and conforming in all respects to the ceremonies of his new religion, he applied himself to the study of history, and occasionally to the art of painting, in which in his younger days he had shown some skill. Deserted by his former friends, and treated in all respects like the worst criminal in the jail, he lingered on, quite cheerful and resigned, until the 1st of November 1793, when he died in his cell, being then only 43 years of age. Many men with fewer sympathies for the distressed and needy, with less abilities and harder hearts, have made a shining figure and left a brilliant fame. He had his mourners. The prisoners bemoaned his loss and missed him, for though his means were not large, his charity was great, and in bestowing alms among them he considered the necessities of all alike, and knew no distinction of sect or creed. There are wise men in the highways of the world who may learn something, even from this poor crazy lord who died in Newgate. To the last he was truly served by bluff John Grueby. John was at his side before he had been 24 hours in the Tower, and never left him until he died. He had one other constant attendant in the person of a beautiful Jewish girl, who attached herself to him from feelings half religious, half romantic, but whose virtuous and disinterested character appears to have been beyond the censure even of the most censorious. Gashford deserted him, of course. He subsisted for a time upon his traffic in his master's secrets, and, this trade failing when the stock was quite exhausted, procured an appointment in the honourable corps of spies and eavesdroppers employed by the government. As one of these wretched underlings, he did his drudgery, sometimes abroad, sometimes at home, and long endured the various miseries of such a station. 10 or 12 years ago, not more, a meagre, wan old man, diseased and miserably poor, was found dead in his bed at an obscure inn in the borough, where he was quite unknown. He had taken poison. There was no clue to his name, but it was discovered from certain entries in a pocket-book he carried that he had been secretary to Lord George Gordon in the time of the famous riots. Many months after the re-establishment of peace and order, and even when it had ceased to be the town talk, that every military officer, kept at free quarters by the city during the late alarms, had cost for his board and lodging £4 per day, and every private soldier 2 and 2½d, many months after even this engrossing topic was forgotten, and the United Bulldogs were to a man all killed, imprisoned, or transported, Mr. Simon Tappertit, being removed from a hospital to prison, and thence to his place of trial, was discharged by proclamation on 2 wooden legs. Shorn of his graceful limbs, and brought down from his high estate to circumstances of utter destitution and the deepest misery, he made shift to stump back to his old master and beg for some relief. By the locksmith's advice and aid, he was established in business as a shoeblack, and opened shop under an archway near the Horse Guards. This being a central quarter, he quickly made a very large connection, and on levy days was sometimes known to have as many as 20 half-pay officers waiting their turn for polishing. Indeed, his trade increased to that extent that in course of time he entertained no less than 2 apprentices, besides taking for his wife the widow of an eminent bone and rag collector, formerly of Millbank. With this lady, who assisted in the business, he lived in great domestic happiness, only chequered by those little storms which served to clear the atmosphere of wedlock and brighten its horizon. In some of these gusts of bad weather, Mr. Tappertit would, in the assertion of his prerogative, so far forget himself as to correct his lady with a brush or boot or shoe, while she, but only in extreme cases, would retaliate by taking off his legs and leaving him exposed to the derision of those urchins who delight in mischief. Miss Miggs, baffled in all her schemes, matrimonial and otherwise, and cast upon a thankless, undeserving world, turned very sharp and sour, and did at length become so acid, and did so pinch and slap and tweak the hair and noses of the youth of Golden Lion Court, that she was by one consent expelled that sanctuary, and desired to bless some other spot of earth in preference. It chanced at that moment that the Justices of the Peace for Middlesex proclaimed by public placard that they stood in need of a female turnkey for the county Bridewell, and appointed a day and hour for the inspection of candidates. Miss Miggs, attending at the time appointed, was instantly chosen and selected from 124 competitors, and at once promoted to the office, which she held until her decease more than 30 years afterwards, remaining single all that time. It was observed of this lady that while she was inflexible and grim to all her female flock, she was particularly so to those who could establish any claim to beauty, and it was often remarked, as a proof of her indomitable virtue and severe chastity, that to such as had been frail she showed no mercy, always falling upon them on the slightest occasion, or on no occasion at all, with the fullest measure of her wrath. Among other useful inventions which she practised upon this class of offenders and bequeathed to posterity, was the art of inflicting an exquisitely vicious poke or dig with the wards of a key in the small of the back near the spine. She likewise originated a mode of treading by accident, in pattens, on such as had small feet, also very remarkable for its ingenuity, and previously quite unknown. It was not very long, you may be sure, before Joe Willet and Dolly Varden were made husband and wife, and with a handsome sum in bank, for the locksmith could afford to give his daughter a good dowry, reopened the Maypole. It was not very long, you may be sure, before a red-faced little boy was seen staggering about the Maypole passage and kicking up his heels on the green before the door. It was not very long, counting by years, before there was a red-faced little girl, another red-faced little boy, and a whole troop of girls and boys, so that, go to Chigwell when you would, there would surely be seen, either in the village street, or on the green, or frolicking in the farmyard, for it was a farm now as well as a tavern, more small Joes and small Dollies than could be easily counted. It was not a very long time before these appearances ensued, but it was a very long time before Joe looked 5 years older, or Dolly either, or the locksmith either, or his wife either, for cheerfulness and content are great beautifiers, and are famous preservers of youthful looks, depend upon it. It was a long time, too, before there was such a country inn as the Maypole in all England. Indeed, it is a great question whether there has ever been such another to this hour, or ever will be. It was a long time, too, for never, as the proverb says, is a long day, before they forgot to have an interest in wounded soldiers at the Maypole, or before Joe omitted to refresh them for the sake of his old campaign, or before the sergeant left off looking in there now and then, or before they fatigued themselves, or each other, by talking on these occasions of battles and sieges, and hard weather and hard service, and a thousand things belonging to a soldier's life. As to the great silver snuff-box which the King sent Joe with his own hand because of his conduct in the riots, what guest ever went to the Maypole without putting finger and thumb into that box, and taking a great pinch, though he had never taken a pinch of snuff before, and almost sneezed himself into convulsions even then? As to the purple-faced vintner, where is the man who lived in those times and never saw him at the Maypole, to all appearance as much at home in the best room as if he lived there? And as to the feastings and christenings and revellings at Christmas and celebrations of birthdays, wedding days, and all manner of days, both at the Maypole and the Golden Key, if they are not notorious, what facts are? Mr. Willet the elder, having been by some extraordinary means possessed with the idea that Joe wanted to be married, and that it would be well for him, his father, to retire into private life and enable him to live in comfort, took up his abode in a small cottage at Chigwell, where they widened and enlarged the fireplace for him, hung up the boiler, and furthermore planted in the little garden outside the front door a fictitious maypole, so that he was quite at home directly. To this, his new habitation, Tom Cobb, Phil Parks, and Solomon Daisy went regularly every night, and in the chimney corner they all four quaffed and smoked and prosed and dozed as they had done of old. It being accidentally discovered after a short time that Mr. Willet still appeared to consider himself a landlord by profession, Joe provided him with a slate, upon which the old man regularly scored up vast accounts for meat, drink, and tobacco. As he grew older, this passion increased upon him, and it became his delight to chalk against the name of each of his cronies a sum of enormous magnitude and impossible to be paid,
and such was his secret joy in these entries that he would be perpetually seen going behind the door to look at them, and coming forth again suffused with the liveliest satisfaction. He never recovered the surprise the rioters had given him, and remained in the same mental condition down to the last moment of his life. It was like to have been brought to a speedy termination by the first sight of his first grandchild, which appeared to fill him with the belief that some alarming miracle had happened to Joe. Being promptly blooded, however, by a skilful surgeon, he rallied, and although the doctors all agreed, on his being attacked with symptoms of apoplexy 6 months afterwards, that he ought to die, and took it very ill that he did not, he remained alive, possibly on account of his constitutional slowness, for nearly 7 years more, when he was one morning found speechless in his bed. He lay in this state, free from all tokens of uneasiness, for a whole week, when he was suddenly restored to consciousness by hearing the nurse whisper in his son's ear that he was going.
"I'm a-going, Joseph," said Mr. Willet, turning round upon the instant, "to the Salwanners,"
and immediately gave up the ghost. He left a large sum of money behind him, even more than he was supposed to have been worth, although the neighbours, according to the custom of mankind in calculating the wealth that other people ought to have saved, had estimated his property in good round numbers. Joe inherited the whole, so that he became a man of great consequence in those parts, and was perfectly independent. Some time elapsed before Barnaby got the better of the shock he had sustained, or regained his old health and gaiety. But he recovered by degrees, and although he could never separate his condemnation and escape from the idea of a terrific dream, he became in other respects more rational. Dating from the time of his recovery, he had a better memory and greater steadiness of purpose, but a dark cloud overhung his whole previous existence and never cleared away. He was not the less happy for this, for his love of freedom and interest in all that moved or grew, or had its being in the elements, remained to him unimpaired. He lived with his mother on the Maypole farm, tending the poultry and the cattle, working in a garden of his own, and helping everywhere. He was known to every bird and beast about the place, and had a name for every one. Never was there a lighter-hearted husbandman, a creature more popular with young and old, a blither or more happy soul than Barnaby. And though he was free to ramble where he would, he never quitted her, but was for evermore her stay and comfort. It was remarkable that although he had that dim sense of the past, he sought out Hugh's dog, and took him under his care, and that he never could be tempted into London. When the riots were many years old, and Edward and his wife came back to England with a family almost as numerous as Dolly's, and one day appeared at the Maypole porch, he knew them instantly, and wept and leapt for joy. But neither to visit them, nor on any other pretence, no matter how full of promise and enjoyment, could he be persuaded to set foot in the streets, nor did he ever conquer this repugnance, or look upon the town again. Grip soon recovered his looks, and became as glossy and sleek as ever, but he was profoundly silent. Whether he had forgotten the art of polite conversation in Newgate, or had made a vow in those troubled times to forego, for a period, the display of his accomplishments, is matter of uncertainty. But certain it is that for a whole year he never indulged in any other sound than a grave, decorous croak. At the expiration of that term, the morning being very bright and sunny, he was heard to address himself to the horses in the stable upon the subject of the kettle, so often mentioned in these pages, and before the witness who overheard him could run into the house with the intelligence, and add to it, upon his solemn affirmation, the statement that it heard him laugh, the bird himself advanced with fantastic steps to the very door of the bar, and there cried,
"I'm a devil! I'm a devil! I'm a devil!"
with extraordinary rapture. From that period, although he was supposed to be much affected by the death of Mr. Willet Senior, he constantly practised and improved himself in the vulgar tongue, and, as he was a mere infant for a raven, when Barnaby was grey, he has very probably gone on talking to the present time. End of chapter 82. End of Barnaby Rudge, A Tale of the Riots of 80, by Charles Dickens. Recorded by Mill Nicholson. Website www.act2scnumber3.com.
Wow. What's up? I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.